You're listening to part two of episode 642 of Unwelcome Guests. We're listening to Daniel Swaler's thoughts on dumpster diving, and if you're into that sort of thing, you could try trashwiki.org. I've been doing it myself for many years, and one occasion I remember, an officious middle-aged woman screamed outrage, "Oi, are you putting things in our skip?" On which occasion I attempted to connect with the human inside her, smiled broadly and waved and said, "No, it's all right, we're taking things out." And I just knew that she wanted an argument. But having gotten so upset about the threat of us putting things in the skip, she was too embarrassed to come out and admit she was equally angered by us taking things out of the skip. So she just shut the window and we got on with the skipping. My interpretation of this was that she could see I was getting something valuable from the skip. Okay, she thought I was getting a valuable dumping ground. As it was, I was getting valuable computers which could be fixed or repaired or used for spares. And because I was getting value, in the money mentality, that meant somebody, she, her organization, was losing value. People are locked into the win-lose situation, and of course they all want to be on the winning side, so they're putting other people on the losing side. I could yarn on this one at length, because moneyed society, organizations, businesses in particular, are steeped in it, and certainly it pervades people's private lives, all the rest of human consciousness. So I can really understand a lot of the things that Daniel Swaler says. I have my own experiences which gel with them. I think most people who didn't find their way out of the rat race, but they've been in conventional type jobs, they know this in their heart of hearts, and yet they can't break free. Their conscious mind is conditioned and controlled by deeper systemic patterns, which, as I see it, all come down to this money, the controlling force. And we return to the valuable insights of Daniel Swaler on the topic of dumpster diving and why corporations, like anal retentive children, try and retain control of their waste. Notice how the tyranny in humans is not from reality, not from humanness, but is scripted programming, paid programming. A human running from the heart and not from a program is not going to guard a dumpster from the hungry. A human running from the heart has common sense, because he or she is not motivated by dollars and cents, not motivated from fear of losing a job. This is the secret in human relations, learning how to see the human beneath the scripted program and appealing to that human. Believe it or not, there is actually a human beneath the facade of corporate managers and cops and their lackeys. We all know what it's like to be a paid employee, compromising who we are so we don't lose our jobs. It's hard. It's hard for the store manager, for the cop, for us. But overcoming what's hard, to be authentic, is the whole point of life. Learn how to be totally real, totally sincere with these robots, and as a result you learn how to wake up the sleeping human within them. I mean, respect them as humans. Never respect them as robots. You can love a human, you cannot love a robot, so don't pretend. Try it. Be bold, be brave, be real. Be wise as a serpent, gentle as a dove.
Walden, Chapter 1, Part 2. Most of the luxuries and many of the so-called comforts of life are not only not indispensable, but positive hindrances to the elevation of mankind. With respect to luxuries and comforts, the wisest have ever lived a more simple and meager life than the poor. The ancient philosophers, Chinese, Hindu, Persian, and Greek, were a class than which none has been poorer in outward riches, none so rich in inward. We know not much about them, It is remarkable that we know so much of them as we do. The same is true of the more modern reformers and benefactors of their race. None can be an impartial or wise observer of human life but from the vantage ground of what we should call voluntary poverty. Of a life of luxury, the fruit is luxury, whether in agriculture or commerce or literature or art. There are nowadays professors of philosophy, but not philosophers. Yet it is admirable to profess because it was once admirable to live. To be a philosopher is not merely to have subtle thoughts, nor even to found a school, but so to love wisdom as to live according to its dictates, a life of simplicity, independence, magnanimity, and trust. It is to solve some of the problems of life, not only theoretically, but practically. The success of great scholars and thinkers is commonly a courtier-like success, not kingly, not manly. They make shift to live merely by conformity, practically as their fathers did, and are in no sense the progenitors of a noble race of men. But why do men degenerate ever? What makes families run out? What is the nature of the luxury which enervates and destroys nations? Are we sure that there is none of it in our own lives? The philosopher is in advance of his age, even in the outward form of his life. He is not fed, sheltered, clothed, warmed, like his contemporaries. How can a man be a philosopher and not maintain his vital heat by better methods than other men? When a man is warmed by the several modes which I have described, what does he want next? Surely not more warmth of the same kind, as more and richer food, larger and more splendid houses, finer and more abundant clothing, more numerous, incessant, and hotter fires, and the like. When he has obtained those things which are necessary to life, there is another alternative than to obtain the superfluities, and that is to adventure on life now, his vacation from humbler toil having commenced. The soil, it appears, is suited to the seed, for it has sent its radical downward, and it may now send its shoot upward, also with confidence. Why has man rooted himself thus firmly in the earth, but that he may rise in the same proportion into the heavens above? For the nobler plants are valued for the fruit they bear at last in the air and light, far from the ground, and are not treated like the humbler esculents, which, though they may be biennials, and cultivated only till they have perfected their root, and often cut down at top for this purpose, so that most would not know them in their flowering season. I do not mean to prescribe rules to strong and valiant natures, who will mind their own affairs, whether in heaven or hell, and perchance build more magnificently and spend more lavishly than the richest, without ever impoverishing themselves, not knowing how they live. If indeed there are any such, as has been dreamed, nor to those who find their encouragement and inspiration in precisely the present condition of things, and cherish it with the fondness and enthusiasm of lovers. And, to some extent, I reckon myself in this number. I do not speak to those who are well employed, in whatever circumstances, and they know whether they are well employed or not, but mainly to the mass of men who are discontented, and idly complaining of the hardness of their lot, or of the times, when they might improve them. There are some who complain most energetically and inconsolably of any, because they are, as they say, doing their duty. I also have in mind that seemingly wealthy, but most terribly impoverished class of all, who have accumulated dross, but know not how to use it or get rid of it, and thus have forged their own golden or silver fetters. If I should attempt to tell how I have desired to spend my life in years past, it would probably surprise those of my readers who are somewhat acquainted with its actual history. It would certainly astonish those who know nothing about it. I will only hint at some of the enterprises which I have cherished. In any weather, at any hour of the day or night, I have been anxious to improve the nick of time, and notch it on my stick, too, to stand on the meeting of two eternities, the past and future, which is precisely the present moment, to toe that line. You will pardon some obscurities, for there are more secrets in my trade than in most men's, and yet not voluntarily kept, but inseparable from its very nature. I would gladly tell all that I know about it, and never paint no admittance on my gate. I long ago lost a hound, a bay horse, and a turtle dove, and am still on their trail. Many are the travelers I have spoken concerning them, describing their tracks and what calls they answered to. I have met one or two who had heard the hound, and the tramp of the horse, and even seen the dove disappear behind a cloud, and they seemed as anxious to recover them as if they had lost them themselves. To anticipate, not the sunrise and the dawn merely, but if possible, nature herself. How many mornings, summer and winter, before yet any neighbor was stirring about his business, have I been about mine? No doubt, many of my townsmen have met me returning from this enterprise, farmers starting for Boston in the twilight, or woodchoppers going to their work. It is true, I never assisted the sun materially in his rising, but, doubt not, it was of the last importance only to be present at it. So many autumn days and winter days, spent outside the town, trying to hear what was in the wind, to hear and carry it express. I well nigh sunk all my capital in it, and lost my own breath into the bargain, running in the face of it. If it had concerned either of the political parties, depend upon it, it would have appeared in the Gazette with the earliest intelligence. At other times, watching from the observatory of some cliff or tree to telegraph any new arrival, or waiting at evening on the hilltops for the sky to fall, that I might catch something, though I never caught much, and that, manna-wise, would dissolve again in the sun. For a long time I was reporter to a journal, of no very wide circulation, whose editor has never yet seen fit to print the bulk of my contributions, and, as is too common with writers, I got only my labor for my pains. However, in this case my pains were their own reward. For many years I was self-appointed inspector of snowstorms and rainstorms, and did my duty faithfully, surveyor, if not of highways, then of forest paths, and all across lot routes, keeping them open, and ravines bridged and passable at all seasons, where the public heel had testified to their utility. I have looked after the wild stock of the town, which give a faithful herdsman a good deal of trouble by leaping fences, and I have had an eye to the unfrequented nooks and corners of the farm, though I did not always know whether Jonas or Solomon worked in a particular field today. That was none of my business. I have watered the red huckleberry, the sand cherry, and the nettle tree, the red pine and the black ash, the white grape and the yellow violet, which might have withered else in dry seasons. In short, I went on thus for a long time, I may say it without boasting, faithfully minding my business, till it became more and more evident that my townsmen would not, after all, admit me into the list of town officers, nor make my place a sinecure with a moderate allowance. My accounts, which I can swear to have kept faithfully, I have indeed never got audited, still less accepted, still less paid and settled. However, I have not set my heart on that. Not long since, a strolling Indian went to sell baskets at the house of a well-known lawyer in my neighborhood. "Do you wish to buy any baskets?" he asked. "No, we do not want any," was the reply. "What?" exclaimed the Indian as he went out the gate. "Do you mean to starve us?" Having seen his industrious white neighbors so well off that the lawyer had only to weave arguments, and by some magic wealth and standing followed, he had said to himself, "I will go into business. I will weave baskets. It is a thing which I can do," thinking that when he had made the baskets, he would have done his part, and then it would be the white man's to buy them. He had not discovered that it was necessary for him to make it worth the other's while to buy them, or at least make him think that it was so, or to make something else which it would be worth his while to buy. I, too, had woven a kind of basket of a delicate texture, but I had not made it worth anyone's while to buy them. Yet, not the less in my case, did I think it worth my while to weave them. And instead of studying how to make it worth men's while to buy my baskets, I studied, rather, how to avoid the necessity of selling them. The life which men praise and regard as successful is but one kind. Why should we exaggerate any one kind at the expense of the others?
Question 2. Do you think money is evil? No, money is illusion. Illusion is neither good nor evil. Attachment to illusion is evil. Attachment to illusion is called idolatry. Few will even question what money really is, because it's so pervasive, like air. Yet, unlike air, money does not exist outside the mind, but is only pervasive in the mind, unless we get into deeper Buddhist philosophy, which points out that all things arise from mind. Contrary to common definitions, money is not gold or silver, cowrie shells or cattle. Money is not bills, it's not credit card, it's not numbers in a bank or tabulations on paper. Money is purely belief in the head. Money exists no place else but in the mind. Money is a strange phenomenon that exists only because two or more people believe it exists. Where two or more are gathered in the belief of money, money is in their midst. To say that I live without money isn't saying anything, really. It's like saying I live without belief in Santa Claus. Now, if we lived in a world where everybody believed in Santa Claus, you might think I'm stepping out on a limb to live without Santa Claus, who never existed. But what if we saw gold for what it is? Gold is pretty, but virtually useless in most cases. Somebody decided it had an inflated worth, and everybody decided to believe this decision. Now a few people see gold for its reality, but they see fictitious values. Natives in North America thought Europeans were utterly insane because of their lust for such a useless yellow substance. What if we spent as much of our wealth and energy on living beings as we do on guarding and revering gold bars at Fort Knox? Gold bars which do nothing, gold bars which don't hear, don't see, don't smell, don't taste, and don't speak, and which provide neither food nor clothing nor shelter nor warmth to a single living being. What if we spent as much of our wealth and energy on living beings as we do on guarding and revering pieces of paper and coins, as well as numbers in databases which do absolutely nothing, which don't hear, don't see, don't smell, don't taste, and don't speak, which provide neither food nor clothing nor shelter nor warmth to a single living being? And there's a quote from the Book of Psalms. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. Eyes they have, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. Noses they have, but they do not smell. They have hands, but they do not handle. Feet they have, but they do not walk. Nor do they mutter through their throat. Those who make them are like them. So is everyone who trusts in them. Imagine that you had eyes that saw reality rather than your own belief. Imagine if you saw a $100 bill as a piece of paper with a pretty work of art on it, and nothing else. Our real selves live without money, always have, and always will. Only our pretend selves can live with and use and own money. Don't get me wrong, that's not even saying that money is evil, or that to pretend is evil. But when we think our pretense is reality, this is when we've sunk into disaster. Think about this, please. I'm tired of living in the pretend world that thinks itself real. I'm tired of being a pretense. People of commerce often tell children and people like us to get real, to join the real world. Now I want you to reconsider who is really in the real world. Really consider this, please. It's kind of funny how those most attached to money always tell me, emphatically, money is not the root of all evil, but the love of money is the root of all evil. Quoting 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10. If only they believe what has just come out of their own mouths. People get emphatic about defending what they most love. Alcoholics in denial are quick to emphatically tell you that alcohol isn't the problem. It's dependence on alcohol that is the problem. They assure you that they can quit any time. Same with a heroin addict in denial, or any other addict in denial. No, heroin is not evil. Problem truly is addiction to heroin. But I ask you this, do you know of anybody who shoots heroin who isn't addicted? And I ask you this, what is more addictive, heroin or money? Now, any AA attender will tell you that the first step in overcoming addiction is to let go of your denial and admit your addiction. Then you can proceed to the next 11 steps, one at a time.
Finding that my fellow citizens were not likely to offer me any room in the courthouse, or any curacy or living anywhere else, but I must shift for myself, I turned my face more exclusively than ever to the woods, where I was better known. I determined to go into business at once, and not wait to acquire the usual capital, using such slender means as I had already got. My purpose in going to Walden Pond was not to live cheaply, nor to live dearly there, but to transact some private business with the fewest obstacles. To be hindered from accomplishing which, for want of a little common sense, a little enterprise and business talent, appeared not so sad as foolish. I have always endeavored to acquire strict business habits. They are indispensable to every man. If your trade is with the Celestial Empire, then some small counting house on the coast in some Salem harbor will be fixture enough. You will export such articles as the country affords, purely native products, much ice and pine timber and a little granite, always in native bottoms. These will be good ventures. To oversee all the details yourself in person, to be at once pilot and captain and owner and underwriter, to buy and sell and keep the accounts, to read every letter received and write or read every letter sent, to superintend the discharge of imports night and day, to be upon many parts of the coast almost at the same time. Often the richest freight will be discharged upon a Jersey shore, to be your own telegraph, unweariedly sweeping the horizon, speaking all passing vessels bound coastwise, to keep up a steady dispatch of commodities for the supply of such a distant and exorbitant market, to keep yourself informed of the state of the markets, prospects of war and peace everywhere, and anticipate the tendencies of trade and civilization, taking advantage of the results of all exploring expeditions, using new passages and all improvements in navigation, charts to be studied, the position of reefs and new lights and buoys to be ascertained, and ever the logarithmic tables to be corrected, for by the error of some calculator the vessel often splits upon a rock that should have reached a friendly pier. There is the untold fate of La Prusse, universal science to be kept pace with, studying the lives of all great discoverers and navigators, great adventurers and merchants, from Hanno and the Phoenicians down to our day. In fine, account of stock to be taken from time, to know how you stand. It is a labor to task the faculties of a man. Such problems of profit and loss, of interest, of tare and tret, engaging of all kinds in it, as demand a universal knowledge. I have thought that Walden Pond would be a good place for business. Not solely on account of the railroad and the ice trade, it offers advantages which it may not be good policy to divulge. It is a good port and a good foundation. No Neva marshes to be filled, though you must everywhere build on piles of your own driving. It is said that a flood tide, with a westerly wind and ice in the Neva, would sweep St. Petersburg from the face of the earth. As this business was to be entered into without the usual capital, it may not be easy to conjecture where those means, that will still be indispensable to every such undertaking, were to be obtained. As for clothing, to come at once to the practical part of the question, perhaps we are led oftener by the love of novelty and a regard for the opinions of men in procuring it than by a true utility. Let him who has work to do recollect that the object of clothing is, first, to retain the vital heat, and secondly, in this state of society, to cover nakedness, and he may judge how much of any necessary or important work may be accomplished without adding to his wardrobe. Kings and queens who wear a suit but once, though made by some tailor or dressmaker to their majesties, cannot know the comfort of wearing a suit that fits. They are no better than wooden horses to hang the clean clothes on. Every day our garments become more assimilated to ourselves, receiving the impress of the wearer's character, until we hesitate to lay them aside without such delay and medical appliances and some such solemnity even as our bodies. No man ever stood the lower in my estimation for having a patch in his clothes, yet I am sure that there is greater anxiety commonly to have fashionable, or at least clean and unpatched clothes, than to have a sound conscience. But even if the rent is not mended, perhaps the worst vice betrayed is improvidence. I sometimes try my acquaintances by such tests as this. Who could wear a patch, or two extra seams only, over the knee? Most behave as if they believed that their prospects for life would be ruined if they should do it. It would be easier for them to hobble to town with a broken leg than with a broken pantaloon. Often, if an accident happens to a gentleman's legs, they can be mended. But if a similar accident happens to the legs of his pantaloons, there is no help for it, for he considers not what is truly respectable, but what is respected. We know but few men, a great many coats and breeches. Dress a scarecrow in your latest shift, you standing shiftless by, who would not soonest salute the scarecrow? Passing a cornfield the other day, close by a hat and coat on a stake, I recognized the owner of the farm. He was only a little more weather-beaten than when I saw him last. I have heard of a dog that barked at every stranger who approached his master's premises with clothes on, but as easily quieted by a naked thief. It is an interesting question how far men would retain their relative rank if they were divested of their clothes. Could you, in such a case, tell surely of any company of civilized men which belonged to the most respected class? When Madame Pfeiffer, in her adventurous travels round the world from east to west, had got so near home as Asiatic Russia, she says that she felt the necessity of wearing other than a traveling dress when she went to meet the authorities, for she was now in a civilized country where people are judged by their clothes. Even in our democratic New England towns, the accidental possession of wealth, and its manifestation in dress and equipage alone, obtain for the possessor almost universal respect. But they yield such respect, numerous as they are so far heathen, and need to have a missionary sent to them. Besides, clothes introduced sewing, a kind of work which you may call endless. A woman's dress, at least, is never done. A man who has at length found something to do will not need to get a new suit to do it in. For him the old will do, that has lain dusty in the garret for an indeterminate period. Old shoes will serve a hero longer than they have served his valet, if a hero ever has a valet. Bare feet are older than shoes, and he can make them do. Only those who go to soirees and legislative balls must have new coats. Coats, too, change as often as the man changes in them. But if my jacket and trousers, my hat and shoes, are fit to worship God in, they will do, will they not? Whoever saw his old clothes, his old coat, actually worn out, resolved into its primitive elements, so that it was not a deed of charity to bestow it on some poor boy, by him perchance to be bestowed on some poorer still, or shall we say richer, who could do with less. I say, beware of all enterprises that require new clothes, and not rather a new wearer of clothes. If there is not a new man, how can the new clothes be made to fit? If you have any enterprise before you, try it in your old clothes. All men want, not something to do with, but something to do, or rather something to be. Perhaps we should never procure a new suit, however ragged or dirty the old, until we have so conducted, so enterprised, or sailed in some way, that we feel like new men in the old, and that to retain it would be like keeping new wine in old bottles. Our molting season, like that of the fowls, must be a crisis in our lives. The loon retires to solitary ponds to spend it. Thus also the snake casts its slough, and the caterpillar its wormy coat, by an internal industry and expansion. For clothes are but our outmost cuticle and mortal coil. Otherwise, we shall be found sailing under false colors, and be inevitably cashiered at last by our own opinion, as well as that of mankind. We don garment after garment, as if we grew like exogenous plants by addition without. Our outside, and often thin and fanciful clothes, are our epidermis, our false skin, which partakes not of our life, and may be stripped off here and there without fatal injury. Our thicker garments, constantly worn, are our cellular integument, or cortex. But our shirts are our liber, or true bark, which cannot be removed without girdling, and so destroying the man. I believe that all races at some seasons wear something equivalent to the shirt. It is desirable that a man be clad so simply that he can lay his hands on himself in the dark, and that he live in all respects so compactly and preparedly that, if an enemy take the town, he can, like the old philosopher, walk out the gate empty-handed without anxiety. While one thick garment is, for most purposes, as good as three thin ones, and cheap clothing can be obtained at prices really to suit customers, while a thick coat can be bought for $5, which will last as many years, thick pantaloons for $2, cowhide boots for $1.50 a pair, a summer hat for $0.25, and a winter cap for 62.5 cents, or a better be made at home at a nominal cost, where is he so poor that, clad in such a suit of his own earning, there will not be found wise men to do him reverence. When I ask for a garment of a particular form, my tailoress tells me gravely, "They do not make them so now," not emphasizing the "they" at all, as if she quoted an authority as impersonal as the fates, and I find it difficult to get what I want, simply because she cannot believe that I mean what I say, that I am so rash. When I hear this oracular sentence, I am for a moment absorbed in thought, emphasizing to myself each word separately that I may come at the meaning of it, that I may find out by what degree of consanguinity they are related to me, and what authority they may have in an affair which affects me so nearly. And finally, I am inclined to answer her with equal mystery, and without any more emphasis of the "they." Quote, "It is true, they did not make them so recently, but they do now." End quote. Of what use this measuring of me if she does not measure my character, but only the breadth of my shoulders, as it were a peg to bang the coat on? We worship not the graces, nor the parse, but fashion. She spins and weaves and cuts with full authority. The head monkey at Paris puts on a traveler's cap, and all the monkeys in America do the same. I sometimes despair of getting anything quite simple and honest done in this world by the help of men. They would have to be passed through a powerful press first, to squeeze their old notions out of them, so that they would not so soon get upon their legs again. And then there would be someone in the company with a maggot in his head, hatched from an egg deposited there, nobody knows when, for not even fire kills these things, and you would have lost your labor. Nevertheless, we will not forget that some Egyptian wheat was handed down to us by a mummy. On the whole, I think that it cannot be maintained that dressing has in this or any country risen to the dignity of an art. At present men make shift to wear what they can get. Like shipwrecked sailors, they put on what they can find on the beach, and at a little distance, whether of space or time, laugh at each other's masquerade. Every generation laughs at the old fashions, but follows religiously the new. We are amused at beholding the costume of Henry VIII or Queen Elizabeth, as much as if it was that of the king and queen of the Cannibal Islands. All costume off a man is pitiful or grotesque. It is only the serious eye peering from and the sincere life passed within it which restrain laughter and consecrate the costume of any people. Let Harlequin be taken with a fit of the colic, and his trappings will have to serve that mood too. When the soldier is hit by a cannonball, rags are as becoming as purple. The childish and savage taste of men and women for new patterns keeps how many shaking and squinting through kaleidoscopes that they may discover the particular figure which this generation requires today. The manufacturers have learned that this taste is merely whimsical. Of two patterns which differ only by a few threads, more or less, of a particular color, the one will be sold readily, the other lie on the shelf, though it frequently happens that after the lapse of a season the latter becomes the more fashionable. Comparatively, tattooing is not the hideous custom which it is called. It is not barbarous merely because the printing is skin-deep and unalterable. I cannot believe that our factory system is the best mode by which men may get clothing. The condition of the operatives is becoming every day more like that of the English, and it cannot be wondered at, since, as far as I have heard or observed, the principal object is not that mankind may be well and honestly clad, but unquestionably that corporations may be enriched.
Question 35. What about clothing and fashion? You might think I made a big sacrifice, giving up money, scaling down my fashion sense. No, 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 quite the contrary. Living moneyless taught me to love fashion. Living moneyless brings out parts of your true character you weren't so aware of previously. Maybe it's my queer eye. Yeah, I wasn't so creative fashion-wise in my money days. Clothes for men in conventional stores are usually quite boring, and thrift stores throw the cool, funky stuff away. If a piece of clothing catches my eye but doesn't fit, I cut it and sew it to fit. I like sewing. I once found a wool blanket and made a hooded monk's robe with it, which could also fold into a very warm and fashionable winter jacket. I designed a black raven swirling with a white dove on the back and a yin-yang pattern. It could be used for sleeping or as a jacket. I feel good wearing something freely acquired, or what I custom design, custom fit, more than I ever felt buying ready-made stuff. And when something wears out, it's exciting not knowing what fashion the universe has in store for me next. I almost always have a nice pair of shoes or boots I either find on the streets or in dumpsters. And thrift stores must not be able to sell socks and underwear, because I find a lot of clean pairs in their dumpsters. I once needed a hat and found a child's black cowboy hat that in no way fit me. I watered it down and stretched it out on a large rock, reshaped it, and voila, I had a custom fit polo hat. Yeah, I find and wear funky fashions I didn't have the nerve or the thought to buy in my money days. The universe knows how to dress us by its laws of randomness, better than we could ever dress ourselves by our own calculations. Lilies are dressed much more fashionably than Solomon in all his glory. People are always wanting to give me clothes too. Look around, nature doesn't dress her creatures in austere robes or rags or penitent-shaped heads. Austere robes and rags are great for times of mourning or protests over excess and attachment. But when your mourning and protest is done and your holy bridegroom is here, you go, girl and boy. Life is not in vain, it's meant to live, and live abundantly. If you doubt me, simply look at all nature's creatures around you, above and below you, and listen to their songs of praise. Bees and butterflies and birds are humming, bless beautiful blossoms, and angels fly to taste your blooming. Okay, I'm sounding silly, but it's true. Why conform to the world and its dictates? Conform to your heart. Your heart sometimes tells you it feels wonderful dressing like people around you, and other times it tells you to dress totally uniquely. Maybe it'll tell you to dress in austere monk's robes or rags, or maybe not. Some folks have asked me why I don't wear special mendicant or religious order clothes. The only reason I can see of wearing them for myself would be to distinguish myself as different, to get people to treat me differently. They might more likely give me food in a begging bowl if I dressed like a Buddhist bhikkhu, a Hindu sadhu, a Muslim fakir, or a Christian mendicant. But the point of my living this way is to join humanity, not separate. I don't want the food of respect of somebody who gives it to me because they think I'm holy, but because they regard me as human. The point of living moneyless is not to manipulate, not to put on an image or to do anything to get reward. Why should anybody not help a frazzled bag lady as much as they would help me?
In the long run, men hit only what they aim at. Therefore, though they should fail immediately, they had better aim at something high. As for a shelter, I will not deny that this is now a necessary of life, though there are instances of men having done without it for long periods in colder countries than this. Samuel Lang says that, quote, "the Laplander in his skin dress and in a skin bag which he puts over his head and shoulders, will sleep night after night on the snow. in a degree of cold which would extinguish the life of one exposed to it in any woolen clothing." End quote. He had seen them asleep thus, yet he adds, quote, "They are not hardier than other people." End quote. But probably the man did not live long on the earth without discovering the convenience which there is in a house, the domestic comforts, which phrase may have originally signified the satisfactions of the house more than of the family, though these must be extremely partial and occasional in those climates where the house is associated in our thoughts with winter, or the rainy season chiefly, and two-thirds of the year, except for a parasol, is unnecessary. In our climate, in the summer, it was formerly almost solely a covering at night. In the Indian gazettes, a wigwam was the symbol of a day's march, and a row of them, cut or painted on the bark of a tree, signified that so many times they had camped. Man was not made so large-limbed and robust, but that he must seek to narrow his world and wall in a space such as fitted him. He was at first bare and out of doors, but though this was pleasant enough in serene and warm weather, by daylight, the rainy season and the winter, to say nothing of the torrid sun, would perhaps have nipped his race in the bud if he had not made haste to clothe himself with the shelter of a house. Adam and Eve, according to the fable, wore the bower before other clothes. Man wanted a home, a place of warmth or comfort, first of warmth, then the warmth of the affections. We may imagine a time when, in the infancy of the human race, some enterprising mortal crept into a hollow in a rock for shelter. Every child begins the world again to some extent, and loves to stay outdoors even in wet and cold. It plays house as well as horse, having an instinct for it. Who does not remember the interest with which, when young, he looked at shelving rocks or any approach to a cave? It was the natural yearning of that portion, any portion of our most primitive ancestor which still survived in us. From the cave we have advanced to roofs of palm leaves, of bark and boughs, of linen woven and stretched, of grass and straw, of boards and shingles, of stones and tiles. At last we know not what it is to live in the open air, and our lives are domestic in more senses than we think. From the hearth the field is a great distance. It would be well, perhaps, if we were to spend more of our days and nights without any obstruction between us and the celestial bodies, if the poet did not speak so much from under a roof, or the saint dwell there so long. Birds do not sing in caves, nor do doves cherish their innocence in dovecots. However, if one designs to construct a dwelling-house, it behooves him to exercise a little Yankee shrewdness, lest, after all, he find himself in a workhouse, a labyrinth without a clue, a museum, an almshouse, a prison, or a splendid mausoleum instead. Consider first how slight a shelter is absolutely necessary. I have seen Penobscot Indians in this town living in tents of thin cotton cloth, while the snow was nearly a foot deep around them, and I thought that they would be glad to have it deeper to keep out the wind. Formerly, when how to get my living honestly, with freedom left for my proper pursuits, was a question which vexed me even more than it does now, for unfortunately I am become somewhat callous, I used to see a large box by the railroad, 6 feet long by 3 wide, in which the laborers locked up their tools at night, and it suggested to me that every man who has hard pushed might get such a one for $1, and, having bored a few auger holes in it, to admit the air at least, get into it when it rained and at night, and hook down the lid, and so have freedom in his love, and in his soul be free. This did not appear the worst, nor by any means a despicable alternative. You could sit up as late as you pleased, and whenever you got up, go abroad without any landlord or house lord dogging you for rent. Many a man is harassed to death to pay the rent of a larger and more luxurious box, who would not have frozen to death in such a box as this. I am far from jesting. Economy is a subject which admits of being treated with levity, but I cannot so be disposed of. A comfortable house for a rude and hardy race, that lived mostly out of doors, was once made here almost entirely of such materials as nature furnished ready to their hands. Gookin, who was superintendent of the Indians, subject to the Massachusetts colony, writing in 1674, says, quote, "The best of their houses are covered very neatly, tight and warm, with barks of trees, slipped from their bodies at those seasons when the sap is up, and made into great flakes, with pressure of weighty timber, when they are green. The meaner sort are covered with mats, which they make of a kind of bulrush, and are also indifferently tight and warm, but not so good as the former. Some I have seen 60 or 100 feet long, and 30 feet broad. I have often lodged in their wigwams, and found them as warm as the best English houses." End quote. He adds that they were commonly carpeted, and lined within with well-wrought embroidered mats, and were furnished with various utensils. The Indians had advanced so far as to regulate the effect of the wind by a mat suspended over the hole in the roof, and moved by a string. Such a lodge was in the first instance constructed in a day or two at most, and taken down and put up in a few hours, and every family owned one, or its apartment in one. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Gordon Mackenzie. Walden by Henry David Thoreau. Chapter 1. Economy. Part 3. In the savage state, every family owns a shelter as good as the best, and sufficient for its coarser and simpler wants. But I think that I speak within bounds when I say that, though the birds of the air have their nests, and the foxes their holes, and the savages their wigwams, in modern civilized society not more than one-half the families own a shelter. In the large towns and cities, where civilization especially prevails, the number of those who own a shelter is a very small fraction of the whole. The rest pay an annual tax for this outside garment of all, become indispensable summer and winter, which would buy a village of Indian wigwams, but now helps to keep them poor as long as they live. I do not mean to insist here on the disadvantage of hiring compared with owning, but it is evident that the savage owns his shelter because it costs so little, while the civilized man hires his commonly because he cannot afford to own it, nor can he, in the long run, any better afford to hire. But, answers one, by merely paying this tax, the poor civilized man secures an abode which is a palace compared with the savages. An annual rent of from $25 to $100, these are the country rates, entitles him to the benefit of the improvements of centuries, spacious apartments, clean paint and paper, Rumford fireplace, back plastering, Venetian blinds, copper pump, spring lock, a commodious cellar, and many other things. But how happens it that he who is said to enjoy these things is so commonly a poor civilized man, while the savage, who has them not, is rich as a savage, If it is asserted that civilization is a real advance in the condition of man, and I think that it is, though only the wise improve their advantages, it must be shown that it has produced better dwellings without making them more costly. And the cost of a thing is the amount of what I will call life which is required to be exchanged for it, immediately or in the long run. An average house in this neighborhood costs, perhaps, $800, and to lay up this sum will take from 10 to 15 years of the laborer's life, even if he is not encumbered with a family. Estimating the pecuniary value of every man's labor at $1 a day, for if some receive more, others receive less, so that he must have spent more than half his life, commonly, before his wigwam will be earned, if we suppose him to pay a rent instead. This is but a doubtful choice of evils. Would the savage have been wise to exchange his wigwam for a palace on these terms? It may be guessed that I reduce almost the whole advantage of holding this superfluous property as a fund in store against the future, so far as the individual is concerned, mainly to the defraying of funeral expenses. But perhaps a man is not required to bury himself. Nevertheless, this points to an important distinction between civilized man and the savage. And no doubt, they have designs on us for our benefit, in making the life of a civilized people an institution, in which the life of the individual is to a great extent absorbed, in order to preserve and perfect that of the race. But I wish to show at what a sacrifice this advantage is at present obtained, and to suggest that we may possibly so live as to secure all the advantage without suffering any of the disadvantage. What mean ye by saying that the poor ye have always with you, or that the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge? As I live, saith the Lord God, ye shall not have occasion any more to use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. As the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son is mine. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. When I consider my neighbors, the farmers of Concord, who are at least as well off as the other classes, I find that for the most part they have been toiling 20, 30, or 40 years, that they may become the real owners of their farms, which commonly they have inherited with encumbrances, or else bought with hired money, and we may regard 1/3 of that toil as the cost of their houses, but commonly they have not paid for them yet.
Ah, people getting into debt in order to save money, people working hard on things that mean nothing to them in order to have an easy life. The more it changes, the more it stays the same, and yet I have a vision that things are likely to change, things are changing in an unprecedented fashion. If Quaylord's way of life is appealing to you, as it is to me, I'd encourage you to try out some of his ideas, strange though they may be. If you haven't heard Swelo before, you might want to check out episode 600 on Giftivism. This show, and all previous shows, are gifts to you from the Unwelcome Guests Collective. You can download this show or any previous episode from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Keep giving all you can, and taking all you need.